I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 1976. The album is Cletus Maggard and the Citizens Band, The White Knight. The artist, the true artist, is Jay Hughley. And my guest this week on what we're going to, I hope this is going to be a little mini-series that we're going to call Family Albums, where I interview the family members of people who created fascinating, sometimes obscure comedy albums. My guest this week on the phone is Rand Hughley. Thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome. Happy to do it.
So Jay was your father.
He was.
And, okay, so here's the thing. I'm fascinated with CB culture and how it kind of took over comedy and just music in general. I'm curious, so I know that your dad, he was in advertising at one point. Was he in advertising before?
Yeah, well, it's funny because when you read anything that pops up online about him or even on the back of the album jacket, he's always described as an advertising executive.
Uh-huh.
And that was such a short, brief stopover in his life. He was a classically trained actor.
Yeah.
Attended Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in London. And I really grew up living backstage in dressing rooms at dinner theaters all over the South. We'd travel around. He was a director, an actor. He had a touring company, and we did that for years and years. And only, it's my fault, only because I became of school age, and my mother said, you know, Jay, we can't just live 3 months at a time in different places putting on Music Man and Man of La Mancha and all these plays. You're going to have to get a job. So he managed to land this job in advertising because it had a creative aspect to it. And he thought, well, if I'm going to do a desk job, I have to do something creative.
Sure.
But the truth is, he really was only there for about 18 months total and hated it. He just was not built to be behind a desk. He was an entertainer. He was a performer and was miserable in it and then just accidentally stumbled into this.
That's crazy. That's the funny thing is if you reverse engineer it, it throws you because first of all, if you look at the jacket cover, there are 13 different versions of him standing around this truck. He's in all kinds of different outfits, including a colonial outfit, which I cannot explain, but I really enjoy. And then, yeah, it's all the Citizens Band. It's all CB related musical humor on the back. He's got this look that's just, it's as country, it's as CB as you can get. And then if you reverse engineer it, this guy's done a good job. I mean, this is presentation at its best in terms of comedy albums, because the guy, again, classically trained.
Yeah, absolutely. And all of those, everything on the front cover, him and all the different costumes, all of that tracks to one of the songs that's on the album. So like you mentioned the Colonial, there's a song on the album called CB76 where he imagines, you know, what would our founding fathers have sounded like if they were on CB radio?
Oh yes, right, of course. Well, there we go. See,
you've got the guy in the Beaver Patrol shirt.
Yep,
the 50s CB rock, and the trooper standing right in front there is that's the White Knight, and so that's where the idea was came from. So
that's so funny.
But yeah, that look on the back, I mean, that's just him acting. That's just him giving a look of what he thinks this guy Cletus Maggard would be like.
Now, where was he originally from, your father?
So he grew up in eastern Kentucky, actually, in a town called Jackson. He was born in Richmond, but grew up mostly in Jackson, Kentucky. And really in hill country, coal country, and knew from a young age that he had a talent and was going to pursue it, and that ended up leading him to the scholarship to go pursue his training in London and so forth. And so, you know, he left there, but he obviously kind of drew on those roots with all of these characters that he created on this album.
Where did he get the idea to make this album? Other than let's capitalize on a trend, like, to go through the effort of getting the money and recording an album at the time, it was more expensive than it is now. I'm curious, like, what really solidified it for him to make this album at all?
Well, here's what happened. He made the single, The White Knight, by accident, and the album then followed after the single was successful. And he, when he was working at Leslie Advertising in Greenville, South Carolina, that was the day job that my mom required him to get. They had a Sears and Roebuck was a major client, and Sears was carrying a line of CB radios by a producer called Jimtronics. And he was tasked with writing a jingle. That's what they used to call the songs that they play on radio commercials. He was to write a jingle for Jimtronics. So he knew not the first thing about CB radios. Spent half an afternoon sitting in a car with a borrowed CB radio, listening to people talk on the CB. And these crazy things they would say, and 10-4 and catch you on the flip side, 7-3's to you, and all this other stuff. And he said, I have no idea what this means, but I think I can throw a few of those things in. And when you listen to the first verse of The White Knight, it's really just this guy kind of talking about driving along and listening to CB radio. And that's really what he wrote as the jingle. And they played it for the client. The client came in, they had a meeting, and I'll just picture people in suits and ties sitting around a boardroom. They play this this little jingle that my dad has come up with, and the client says, that's terrible, we hate it.
Oh, no.
We have no interest in this. You're fired as our agency. Uh-oh. And they literally walked out of the meeting. So my dad is sitting there, and he's thinking, oh, God, I'm fired. And his boss is with him in the meeting, Bill Leslie, who owned the agency. Doesn't say anything for a couple of minutes. Looks like he's pondering something. Kind of looks over at my dad and says, you think you can write two more verses and a bridge? And my dad says, yeah. And he says, they didn't like it, but I think that's a hit record. And that's a true story. So he went home. He came up with the full story idea for the song, which is this state trooper in Georgia who's conning truckers into thinking that he's part of the convoy, which was a major part, obviously, of CB culture, and then catching them, you know, letting them in on the entrapment at the end of the song. So he puts it together. They hired some session musicians right there in South Carolina, recorded it, took it to a local radio station in Greenville, asked them if they would play it. My dad said, there is no way I am releasing this under my name. I don't know what this is. I don't know how this is going to be received. This could ruin my future career if I get back into acting or anything else. And released it under the name Cletus Maggard and the Citizens Band. And it starts playing like wildfire on the radio there in South Carolina. And I have very strong memories of my dad having myself and my mom and our friends call the radio station, and we had to call every hour and say, I want to hear that White Knight song by Cletus Maggard. And we just kept calling and requesting it and requesting it, and it took off. It's one of those crazy American pop culture deals. It caught on, and the next thing he knows, he's got a record on the charts under his fake name, and people want to know who's Cletus Maggard and book him for events, and there is no Citizens Band. It doesn't exist. So that's how it got started. And then, obviously, at that point, Mercury Records comes in, signs him to a record contract, and asks him to fill out an album so they can release an album under the White Knight name, because there's a thirst for it at that point. People are looking for this album to buy, and one doesn't exist.
That's insane. It's so funny to hear basically the story of most early rock and roller and most like garage bands that ever succeed. It's like, well, there's this one thing that they did. They didn't know if it would take off. And then, like you're saying, you know, it gets handed to a DJ. This is happening in what I'm assuming 75, since the album is 76.
Yeah, that's exactly right. All of that happens in 75. And then he records the album in like early 76.
That's hilarious to me. Now, was this, well, I guess I could actually probably tell myself if I just look on the back just to see where this was. Okay, recorded in Greenville, South Carolina. Okay. Got a full band, of course. I'm assuming studio musicians. Or were these people he knew?
So these are studio musicians, and the White Knight definitely recorded in South Carolina. And you see that there on the jacket, Bob Hooper, WESE Radio. That's the station that started playing it. And then session musicians that were pulled together by Jerry Kennedy, who was high up at Mercury. They recorded. Basically, what my dad did is he wrote the he came up with these ideas for songs, wrote these comedy lyrics, came in with the ideas and the vaguest of melodies. And all they really did is just played sort of very generic bluegrass tracks behind it and recorded it in a really short period of time. Then he had to go out on the road. And my mother grew up in northwestern Kentucky on the Ohio River in a town called Owensboro, Kentucky. And he found a band there, and I don't even remember what they called themselves. They had some other name, and they were just a local bluegrass kind of cover band playing bars and playing weddings and that sort of thing. And he hired them to go on the road with him as the citizen's band. And all of a sudden, there were real people here.
That's nuts. How well did the album do?
So, you know, the single obviously went to number one.
Yep.
It actually went to number 19 on the pop charts, believe it or not.
Crazy.
Crossover hit.
Yeah.
As they used to say. And the album sold on the strength of the single. There were only so many singles you were going to sell. They got the album cut and released as quickly as they could, and it sold well. And I don't remember, you know, in numbers and if it was certified gold, but it sold well. There was another song on it, Kentucky Moonrunner, that was released as a single, and I think it peaked out like at number 25 or something in that area. It did okay,
mm-hmm.
And it just kind of faded from there. But for a good solid year, he toured regularly and was easily as well known at that time as C.W. McCall. You know,
yeah.
Today people still kind of remember Convoy and C.W. McCall.
Sure.
And I don't think anybody remembers Cletus Maggard, but they were on par for a while, and they even toured together. They played some double bills.
That's crazy,
which kind of made sense. Yeah,
I apologize. I'm going to have to ask questions where you may not know the answer, but feel free to say I don't know. But do you know if it was? Again, he's playing a character. He's doing a thing that isn't him. But I mean. As an actor myself, I feel like that would be fulfilling, even if it was some weird, silly shit I was doing. Do you know if it was fulfilling for him?
Yeah, I really think it was. Well, look, first of all, it was financially rewarding.
Of course, sure.
For a short period of time. And there was a lot of adulation. He had fan clubs. But what was really interesting is that, in the touring aspect of it, he really, I think, connected with those audiences. And that completely surprised him. He's been in the theater for years. You're performing to a different kind of crowd. Suddenly you're at a concert, and there were these CB clubs. The one I remember in particular were called the Baltimore Breakers. And they just loved him, and they would follow him around.
Oh, my God.
He wrote all these songs, which, if you knew him and knew the kind of music he really liked and the taste that he had and so forth, he thought he hated country music, and he was kind of putting it down when he wrote the song. But I think ultimately he developed a real affinity for truckers,
mm-hmm.
and kind of the profession and what they went through. And I think it became very rewarding. I mean, yeah, it was like being in a show. It was not that different than taking, a play on the road, but it was more personal, and he had more connection with the audience. And you mentioned he had a second album. It didn't sell at all, but he really put more of himself into that, and he made, I think, a much greater effort to put out something that was, it was called Two More Sides, and
uh-huh.
it's half comedy and half serious, and none of it's CB.
Oh my God, I was wondering, I couldn't tell from reading the track listing, because it came out the same year. So he was busting his ass to get two records out. So one of them is one half is completely serious?
It's not like, it's half the songs are serious, half the songs are comedy.
Yeah.
Interspersed. So it's not like there's a serious side and then a comedy side.
Okay, gotcha.
But it's a mixture. So you have a comedy song and a serious song, and a comedy song and a serious song. And the serious songs, he worked with another songwriter named Lynn Chariaka, and I mean, he really was ready to kind of almost make a serious go of it as a country songwriter, something he never could have imagined.
Wow.
But unfortunately, the album didn't do well, although I would rather listen to that one than the first one, to be honest. The first one is fun, and it was popular and it was part of this amazing wave on the one song, mm-hmm. But it was really kind of thrown together quickly. And if he didn't find it somewhat rewarding to have gone on the whole ride in the first place, he never would have tried to come back around and do that second album.
Right. Now, here's something I'm curious about, because I never know. I don't ever necessarily shy away from interviewing people who are the kids of either celebrities or kids of performers. I've been going out of my way, and you're the first where I'm doing this, where I'm wanting to interview the children of people who I had never heard of before, picked up their album. And I'll be honest, my standards are, as long as it's not insanely racist or mean or upsetting, and I get a chuckle out of it, that's enough for me to want to find out more. And what's crazy is we're 18 minutes into it, and I'm so much more fascinated by we're getting into even the more crazy, wonderful things that ended up happening to him career-wise. But I also love that there is this potential for him to maybe become a country songwriter after not... I've had that experience before in art, where it just something clicks with you and it's like, I didn't like this before, mm-hmm. but all of a sudden it means mm-hmm. something to me. And I'm curious, because sometimes people grow up with in families where something like this might have been a disappointment and they never wanted to talk about it again. But it sounds like you know enough of the story that it must have still been a thing that the family talked about. It was just a big part of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I was 8 years old in 76 when The White Knight really hit and the album came out. And I was old enough to have vivid memories of it. But yeah, we did continue to talk about it. He's got, I told you, I don't know how many albums the album sold, but the single was gold. We've got the gold record hanging on our wall, actually, in our house.
Amazing.
We have a lot of the memorabilia. I mean, Jason, we had t-shirts with a picture on them.
So good.
There was a little action figure, you know?
Like, oh my God.
In that jean jacket and jean pants and the Cletus Magritte hat that he's wearing on the front of the kind of fishing hat that he wore on the album. And there was a printed up Stevie Lingo dictionary. We had all this junk forever around the house that was sold. But yeah, I think it surprised him that he fell into it. He kind of whipped this thing out on a lark. It was hugely successful, and then he found something there that he connected with and never really expected to, and made that serious effort at the second album. Of course, the irony is that when he tried his best, it didn't work.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a commentary on his skills at all.
Sure,
Like I said, I kind of like the second album. It just, he tapped into popular culture. He came out with this funny song when CB radios were at their zenith. The other popular songs about CB radio, like Convoy and Teddy Bear by Merle Haggard, and those songs were very serious.
Yep.
And, you know, here was one that kind of poked fun at the whole deal, but yet did it in a way that the truckers didn't feel put down at all. They felt like this is a guy who kind of gets it and gets the humor in it. And, it's just one of those crazy things that catches lightning in a bottle. And then when he came back around, there wasn't that same wave of popular culture to ride, really, with the second album.
Right. God, it's crazy that it was so mercurial, that it was that quick that it could turn on him. It's interesting to me too, because there's a big, and there still is, there has been since truckers were a thing, but there's been kind of there's been CB or trucker comedy that you can only get at truck stops, basically. And mm-hmm. what's interesting though is that, like, he was at, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the beginning of that being a thing, and yet he also hit the pop charts with it too, which is fascinating to me.
And I don't know on that one if that, because the trucker subculture really was kind of a subculture, and I don't know if it crossed over because people just like the humor in the song.
Mm-hmm.
This is the 70s, and so you've got Ray Stevens cutting hit records.
Sure.
You've got other people. It was a little, in my recollection anyway, a little more common to be able to cut a comedy hit and chart with it, even on the pop charts.
Right.
So, of course, it wasn't just truckers, though, that were using the CB radios. I mean, when it was really at its zenith, people were using those because we had the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, and that's what really tripped that, was going down to the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit in whenever that was, 73, 74, to save gas. And that's just too slow. I would say today, that's too slow.
Yeah.
And nobody wanted to drive 55, and this was a way to do it. Because you notice when you listen to the album, part of the CB culture is about lonely truckers connecting when they got nobody else to talk to. But that's secondary to the idea, which was to beat Old Smokey and make sure that we were able to speed in a way that nobody got caught and got away with it. And for a trucker, of course, that's their livelihood. They got to get that shipment there on time. But just for the regular driver, I do remember us having a CB radio in our little sedan. And same thing, just talking to other people. Where are the cops? Where do I need to slow down? Where can I speed up? And that's kind of what it was all about.
Man, it's so funny that that's this weird, it's this interesting Wild West, but everybody had access to it because of, this technology that allowed all these people to connect. You know, and something I didn't know about either until I think a couple of years ago were the CB business card, or not business cards, but the calling cards that would have, you know, your, where you were on the dial, what your handle was. Those things are great. Yeah, it's a whole culture that is documented fairly well, and then there's stuff like this that's also brings it so into pop culture that it's pretty fascinating. As a result of this album, though, did you guys move right to Los Angeles? What's the story? How quickly did this kind of stuff happen?
Never moved to Los Angeles.
You never did. Okay.
Moved to Nashville.
Nashville, okay.
Well, my dad eventually moved to Los Angeles, but that was an entirely different career. That was a career that he was really a lot more proud of, which were the 6 years he spent as a staff writer writing episodes of Magnum PI.
Yeah.
And that's really where he kind of landed, but we can circle back to that.
Sure.
Moved to Nashville in August of 76, left South Carolina. He had signed the record deal. They had signed the deal for the second album. They wanted to get to work on the second album. And there was no reason to stay at the advertising agency that he hated. We actually had some family ties to Nashville anyway, with both my parents being from Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather had gone to Vanderbilt Law School in the 30s. And so Nashville was a place that was comfortable for us to head to anyway. But, yep, moved to Nashville. And settled in, and he made about a 2-year attempt there at really being a serious country recording artist.
Wow, a full 2 years. Okay, so yeah, see, this is some of the stuff that doesn't show up online. It kind of just skips all that. It's like, and then he became a writer for TV.
Right. Yeah, that didn't happen until 1982. So mm-hmm. There's some space to fill in there.
Yeah, man.
The 2 years was, I mean, you're right, the second album came out in late 76, but it was almost constant touring, definitely in 76, and then really throughout 77 and even a little bit into early 78. He had his fans, and his fans, his little core base, those Baltimore Breakers and those other CB clubs, they didn't go away easily, and it might be a large venue, or it might just be the state fairground somewhere, or it might be some really small concert hall, but he pretty much had a gig to play for about 2 years straight.
That's crazy. That is crazy. Did he, now, was there any, in terms of, you know, like you say, 2 years of trying out being a country songwriter, I mean, did anything hit? Did he sell any songs? What happened during that period?
So on the second album, they released a single called Virgil and the $300 Vacation, which was about this kind of redneck guy who sells his family on the idea of going to Washington, D.C., and the whole thing's only going to cost him $300. He's got it all figured out, and these terrible things happen, and it ends up costing like $10,000. It charted at, I think, number 75 or something, and the writing was starting to be on the wall, but the Cletus Maggard kind of country trucker redneck voice thing was played out.
Sure.
But there's a song on that second album, Two More Sides, called The Torn Flag,
mm-hmm.
which is a serious song about the night Abraham Lincoln was assassinated because my father was a huge history buff.
Okay.
And a huge fan of Lincoln. And that was released and did reasonably well. But he did sell a song that called My Turn, which was recorded by Ann Murray and then was eventually actually recorded by Reba McEntire.
Wow.
And they both had minor hits with it. It's a slow, serious ballad. It's a love ballad, and he co-wrote it with that guy I had mentioned, Lynn Chariot. He had a little success with that, but it just kind of, he accomplished a lot of things in his life because he was very, very talented, but he was also always kind of on to the next thing if the first thing wasn't just completely successful.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he did by 79, we had bought a large house in Nashville. He had bought a lot of fancy things. The money was running out, and he went back on the road and actually went back to acting in dinner theaters for a few years and even was on Broadway.
Wow.
In the summer of 82 in a play called Play Me a Country Song, which was like a truck stop version of the TV show Cheers.
Wow.
And he was the Sam Malone character behind the bar. And that only ran for a couple of months in New York, but he did that and then fell into the TV writing when some former actor friend of his was on a show called Baba Black Sheep, which later became known as Black Sheep Squadron.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the first show produced by Donald Belisario, who went on to do Quantum Leap and Magnum and Tales of the Gold Monkey and some other shows. And his friend got him an invitation to write a spec script for Tales of the Gold Monkey, which was kind of an Indiana Jones knockoff show. And he wrote a couple, they bought him, and then Don Belisario offered him the job on Magnum.
Wow.
And he wrote for that for its entire run.
That's nuts. Now, what I realized is I didn't ask you earlier, did he have any songwriting experience before this album?
No formal songwriting experience at all.
Oh, although, my God.
And I don't mean to sound critical because I think some of the songs are really clever.
Sure.
But I don't know if that if it really counts as songwriting.
Okay.
He wrote clever little poems and did voices and sort of hummed a melody to himself as he sang these poems. And these session musicians were really just recording these very generic tracks behind it. So, but he certainly... What he did do in the dinner theater days is oftentimes take well-known plays, Broadway plays that they were doing, and he would recut them somewhat. He might cut a line out. He might even rewrite an entire scene, either for time or for content or for just knowing that the way something played on Broadway in New York was not the way it was going to play in, say, Memphis or Charlotte or wherever we happened to be touring at the time. And so he had writing experience in that sense. And in fact, that's kind of why his actor friend told him, you know, you can write TV scripts. I've seen you write. You can write TV scripts. And I think he put a lot of that into this album, just the composition of things, whether it's a funny little rhyme or a clever turn of story. I think really, you know, at heart, he was a writer, and it just took a while for that to naturally emerge from him.
What was do you remember the name of the actor who made that connection?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Close family friend, a guy named Jeff McKay. And like I said, Jeff was on Black Sheep Squadron.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff was on Magnum. He played the character called Ice Pick, who was a Navy buddy. And he also played Mac. He played two characters on Magnum who were different Navy buddies of Thomas Magnum's. Jeff had a nice little career and was a great guy, funny, gentle, humane. Really good friend of the family, and had moved to L.A. in the mid-70s to try to make it in TV. Stayed in touch with my dad, and when things were really drying up for him, he was the one who called him and said, you have this talent. Trust me. I'm out here. I read the scripts people write for me every day. They're not good. You can do this. You can do better.
That's great. Yeah, you know what's funny, too, is now that I'm looking him up on IMDb, you can see how many different shows he worked on that your father also wrote on. That's great. There's also a little bit of where did I see it? There's some Airwolf as well, which is great.
Airwolf, absolutely. Oh, so my dad wrote some of those. He
love
sure did.
It. Yep. That's nuts. Yep. I mean, I guess it's not that crazy, but this is one of the last eras where you could be recommended on someone's word for a job and then work for, you know, a very popular TV show for 8 years. I mean, it's crazy to me.
It's, you know, what he got from the recommendation was the ability to write one or two spec, what they call a spec script for Tales of Gold Monkey. So you don't have a job. You're just some guy and you sit in your living room and you write a script.
Sure.
But he at least got it read is what happened. Mm-hmm. And it, because they liked what he wrote, that really led to him getting the job. But you're right. It's crazy. And it's not that different from going back and you look at how Cletus Mackert started. Mm-hmm. And you got a guy who runs an advertising agency saying, hey, can you write two more verses in a bridge? And I'm going to take this down to my buddy at the radio station.
It's crazy.
It would be crazy today. It could happen that easily.
It's just nice to hear because it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, you hear the luck part and you forget the rest, but it's luck. But then unless you can apply some skill to that luck, you're not going to get anywhere. So it's kind of great that he found this weird calling that he probably didn't know he had.
Yeah, that's right. Luck to get in the door, talent to stay there. And he definitely was a talented guy for sure.
Did you, off of this first album, I know, like you say, you like the second one best, and I'm going to have to pick up a copy now, but based on that recommendation.
I'll get it to you, yeah.
Oh, that'd be amazing. Do you have a favorite track off of the first album?
I do. But I like the CB Lingo Dictionary, which is the next to last track on side two. And this is where he goes through for a novice and mm-hmm. tries to explain what all of these different crazy... with this jargon and terminology that's being used on the CB. And I like the way it's put together. I think that one is truly finding in places. Of course, I know that he was a novice, and he has this great way of sounding like this patient, almost patronizing guy trying to explain this to a newbie, and he's a newbie. But I think because he was a newbie is why he was able to see the humor in some of these terms they were using. And just come at it with fresh eyes. So that's definitely my favorite track. I do think the White Knight holds up pretty well, and there's a reason that was a hit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I am personally featured in track three on side one, Dad, I Gotta Go.
I was wondering.
The lament of every father on a road trip, and we're just starting to make time, and we're just catching up to the pack, and there comes that voice from the back seat, Dad, I gotta go. I gotta go. And so I played a role in that one.
That's great.
To have a little personal affinity for it.
Of course. Of course. That's a friggin' delight. Now, what about on the second album? What's do you have a particular favorite off of that or a few favorites off of that one?
Oh, you know, there's several good songs on that. I like a couple of the serious ones. There's one called Poppin' 'Em,
mm-hmm.
which is about what it sounds like. It's about the fact that truckers, to do the job they have and get where they need to be and drive these 18-hour shifts, are popping speed left and right, and kind of being addicted to that. There's a song called Bear Blue about a state trooper who's a friend of the truckers and is murdered, actually.
Oh,
and
my God.
The truckers all track down the murderer and avenge him. I like the music to it. The comedy ones, There's a really funny one called the Banana Bowl, which is about a university that completely gives up academics and puts all its money into getting the football team to the Banana Bowl, because their polling shows that's the only reason anybody wants to go there is cheer on the football team. There's one called What Are They Teaching My Boy Floyd, which is about this old Southern guy who doesn't like that they're teaching sex education in the school. That's pretty funny.
That's pretty great. Oh, my goodness. I'm going to, you know, I'm also now tempted to, if we get to connect here in Los Angeles sometime, I mean, your voice is on the record. I had Bob Newhart's son sign a record that Bob Newhart mentioned him on. I feel like I need to have you sign my copy of The White Knight, if only because
Absolutely.
You're on the darn thing. I mean, come on. That's too much fun.
Oh, I know. I'm the inspiration for that song. I don't think my voice is actually on there.
Oh, okay.
They didn't record me saying, Dad, I got to go.
Well, it's the same.
I'll sign it anyway.
It's the same. Bob Newhart's son is not on that album. He's only mentioned. It's the first time he's mentioned. It's just as good to me. My goodness. Now, I'm curious if he's a theater guy. theater people, I don't want to generalize too much, can be very serious, but I'm curious if there was, what kind of comedy there was around the house, if you guys had any comedy albums floating around.
You know, that's an interesting question. He was not a serious guy all the time. He used to joke about his dramatic phase when he was younger, before I was born, when he was in London and and wanted to be the next Orson Welles and took himself very seriously. By the time I came along, he didn't take himself and things as seriously, and he was a delight to be around and was funny all the time. He wasn't one, honestly, to listen to other people's work that much.
Okay.
He was kind of busy doing what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I had comedy albums when I was a kid. I had Steve Martin, Comedy Is Not Pretty, and I had Robin Williams and Gallagher. I used to listen to that stuff like crazy, but it didn't come from my dad.
Okay.
He just wasn't one to... He didn't, in anything he did, really draw on influences. He had his own kind of thing he wanted to do or say, and that's what he did. And otherwise, he spent his leisure time, he was much more likely to just watch sports or be with family or go out to an event than to really listen to other people's comedy.
That's interesting.
I will say, I'm sorry, I don't mean to
interrupt. No, you're fine.
Having said that, it's not as though he didn't have influences, because he did love George Carlin. And he used to talk about George Carlin all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me he used to have tapes of George Carlin, and I don't know how he got them. So we didn't have those albums laying around the house, but he was definitely influenced by George Carlin, Richard Pryor. Used to like to watch the old VHS of Richard Pryor Live on the Sunset Strip.
Sure.
Yep.
Oh, that's good. Well, I mean, if you're going to pick some stuff to listen to and be influenced by, those are the greats. I mean, that's
absolutely
nothing wrong with that. Now, this is something I've never had the opportunity to ask somebody about. Did you ever have moments as a kid where you had the opportunity to brag on your dad and nobody believed you? It feels like that'd be one of those things where, like, my dad had a gold record. I mean, like, I'm just curious if that ever came up.
That's a great question. As a kid today, at 50 years old, sure, I still try to practice.
Still do. Good.
And people are incredulous. It's not that they don't believe me, but it's kind of like you. It sounds like one of those made-up stories, only in America in the 1970s kind of thing.
Yeah.
And people certainly, I've not run into many people who have heard of him or remember him or say, oh, my God, your dad was Cletus Maggard.
Right.
I've done the same thing as far as him writing for Magnum, and there was a time that was a big deal.
There was a time,
certainly in the 80s when it was on TV, and even in the 90s, you could say my dad was from Magnum PI, and people would really treat me as though I had done something special. I find that today I'm surprised how many people I meet that if it comes up in conversation and I mention it, that they say, what's Magnum PI? So it just goes to show you that time marches on. Even Tom Selleck and his mustache and story can be forgotten eventually over time. And certainly when it comes to Cletus Maggard, I think for people it's a curiosity. I think they really like the story and find it interesting. And think it's pretty neat.
Yeah.
So it was cool for me.
Of course it would be. I can only imagine if I could brag about some stuff that my dad did, but if my dad had a weird comedy album when I was a kid, I feel maybe I'd hate comedy albums out though now. Who knows? Like it might be, you know, that might have been my rebellion, but this is so great. I'm looking at some other things that I found too. Like there's this person selling a poster on eBay, which actually to me looks like probably a page out of a magazine, but it is a Cletus Maggard poster. Making sure to remind you that he was voted best new male artist by Billboard in 1976.
Best new artist. He was. Can you believe that? We have the award.
Do you? Great.
They didn't televise the CMA Awards back then.
Uh-huh. Right.
But he won the Billboard, but also the CMA Best New Artist in 1976.
So good.
Unbelievable.
I love it. And like I said, it is one of those things too, where it's like, I feel like if you get recognition from a group, even if you're picking, and these people know, they knew what they were getting into. These people didn't think he was necessarily crapping on them, but it's interesting that, you know, you might not be interested in country, but all of a sudden you get this recognition. You're like, well, there's probably something to it. There's probably something to this many people liking what I did and buying it. You know, I mean, it's a simple transaction.
Absolutely. Yeah, he responded to the fact that they liked what he did. And he responded really to that whole culture. And like I said, we ended up with a CB and reached a point where he didn't want to drive anywhere if he didn't get on his CB.
Yeah.
They're an anachronism in American history and culture now, but in a way they're not, because now we have our phone, and we have the internet, and we have Instagram and everything else, and all these ways that people connect that didn't exist in 1976. And this was a way you could be tooling around in your car and connect with someone you never met.
Yeah.
And be as anonymous as you wanted to be, just really just like an online poster or a troll or a name you want to use on Twitter. It kind of was a forerunner to that ability to just reach out and connect, which is interesting. And I think he really took to that.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of all the work he did? And I love that he could have such a varied career. Is there one thing he was most proud of that really, really, like, he kind of set, that he could place hang his hat on, as it were?
Yeah, I would say there were two things. He was proud of some of the work that he did on Magnum.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, Magnum, look, at a lot of levels, was, the quintessential 80s just cop show and not always greatest piece of art in the world, and he would be the first person to tell you that.
Sure.
But because of his roots in England, he became sort of the house writer for the Higgins character, for John Hillerman.
Okay.
And if you are sitting around at night watching a rerun and you see one comes on that features Higgins very prominently, you can almost be assured that he wrote that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he wrote a couple episodes that he was super proud of on Magnum, one called Solo Flight, where Magnum is trapped at the top of a mountain, like under an old aircraft, and kind of goes through this whole process of thinking about his life, and he was really proud of that. Outside of Magnum, he played many roles in the theater, did many plays, but his longest running, the one he did the most, was The Man of La Mancha, which is the play about based on the Don Quixote by Cervantes. And he collected Don Quixote statuettes.
Wow.
Right now, I'm looking at an oil painting that was done of him in full costume.
Oh, my God.
Cody.
Oh, that's amazing.
His spirit, you used the word mercurial earlier to describe what happened with the White Knight, and that's a great word because he was mercurial. He didn't just kind of do one thing for a long, long time. He did all these little things in short bursts and dramatically and wildly successfully, and then just fade away and then go to the next thing. And I think he very much identified with the character of Don Quixote.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of just kind of being out there, maybe not in the right time, but not giving up on your crazy dream, even if it's out of step. And so, yeah, I think he was really proud of how many of her performances that he acted and directed in of Man of La Mancha. And I tell you, it's funny to me to listen to him sing in this nasally southern twang on Cletus Maggard, because he was a classically trained singer with a beautiful voice,
mm-hmm.
and he sang The Impossible Dream for Man of La Mancha in a way that would absolutely quiet the house and make chills go down your spine.
Are there any recordings of that around? Because I got to tell
you,
oh, damn it, because I got to tell you, that's like, boy, oh boy, I would love to hear. Boah, damn it. Well, I'm gonna do some research.
You think you would? I mean, I have
of course.
I would love to hear it again. And it was the 70s, the early 70s at that, really, when he was really doing La Mancha.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the kind of thing where you certainly didn't pull out your phone and
sure.
say, I'm gonna take a video and put this on YouTube. And yeah. Why would we have a tape recording? They just didn't think about that. Yeah. There might have been a recording at one point, but if it ever existed, it's gone.
Yeah. He's got two. So he's got on IMDb. He's got two actor credits. They seem like they're smaller bit parts. One's in a BBC show, and the other one is something called Armchair Theater. And what I love is that he had these opportunities on TV, but his biggest ones were in writing. But that he still held on to Don Quixote, which of course you would. I mean, why would you not make that the thing that is your thing? That sounds
exactly.
That's beautiful.
That's a good one to have. Yeah, those TV roles were when he was in school or just first out of school in mm-hmm. London, and landed a couple of small parts while he was doing theater in London, and actually was married to someone else, a first wife. That didn't work out. He left London, came back to the States, met my mom, but never did any more TV acting after that, just the TV writing.
Have you seen those? I'm guessing they don't even exist anymore.
I've not, yeah. I've never seen those. He said he was always, for whatever reason, he was always cast as a thug, you know, henchman number one or something.
I interviewed a kid for another podcast I do about the TV show News Radio, and on that he played a punk. And then as I'm talking to him, I'm going through his IMDb. I'm like, "You played basically the 90s punk that everybody hated in every show." And he's like, "Yeah, that was my thing. That's how I made a living as a teen." It's so funny how typecast you can be at any given time. That's so funny.
You really can. Well, you know, the funny thing is, you say that, the reason that after years and years of trying to make it to Broadway, the reason he finally made it to Broadway and was cast in that country version of Cheers is because he had Cletus Maggard in his background.
Right.
So right. He goes into that audition, and he's got what they need from an acting standpoint, and he's got the acting chops, and he's got the stage singing chops, but he's got this other little twist, this wrinkle on his resume, and that was typecasting at some level, too.
Yeah. Man, real quick, I will point out that also on eBay, if somebody wants to spend $20 on it, and I'm tempted, they have the unabridged dictionary of CB radio lingo that looks like it was given away with CBs, possibly. It's compliments of Gemtronics. This is phenomenal.
Isn't that funny? Gemtronics are the guys who hated the jingle and rejected it and didn't buy it as a commercial and ended up being one of his primary sponsors for things
phenomenal.
Like that. Yeah, that is... Okay, so if you listen to the CB Lingo Dictionary track
yes.
on the record, and what you're referring to is an expanded version with more terms
mm-hmm.
and his kind of funny little definitions of them, that was actually pretty cool. We had stacks of those around the house, actually, in rubber bands. They couldn't quite give them all away, but that's a pretty cool little item. I don't know if it's worth $20, but...
This person seems to think it is. I love it. It's so weird to me that would sell for more than his album. It's insane to me.
It's weird to me that people still have these things.
Mm-hmm.
You can get the albums on Amazon. You can get
yeah.
them on eBay. And I'll bet if you looked hard enough, you could find one of those T-shirts or something.
For sure. I bet you could.
I don't know why people held on to this stuff, but they did.
You know what's so funny, too, is I'm looking at this and I'm wondering... I'm going to have to check later and see if Mercury ever tried. Do you know if they ever tried to re-release these? Because I feel like I don't know if anybody's ever done this for Truckers, done like, hey, let's do a retro re-release of some stuff that was a hit 40 years ago. I'm wondering.
I know there are several compilations, mm-hmm. greatest CB hits of the 70s.
Oh, okay, sure.
And he pops up on some of those. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple, Jason, that I have heard that are knockoffs. It's not him.
Wow.
It's not the original recording.
Wow.
But... there's that. I don't think Mercury ever re-released the albums, and they're not available on MP3.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't go on iTunes and get them. I look occasionally just to see if they're on there, and
sure.
they're not. So,
man, that's nuts. The song still
plays though every once in a while, because to this day I get a check from BMI at the end of the year for about $6.82. From the occasional airplay of The White Knight.
Holy crap. Now I want to know where that's playing. I want to know what stations are like, you know what? I remember this thing from the 70s. Let's pop this on. I really want to know who's playing that. That's so funny.
You know, every now and again on XM Channel 7, the 70s channel, they'll uh-huh. do a CB weekend. They'll
oh.
do something like that. I think that's probably when it plays.
That makes sense. Oh my! There were enough CB songs. See, now this is like, I keep thinking I've gone down the rabbit hole far enough, but clearly I have not.
It's a never ending rabbit hole.
I have a record that is all like the serious version of what your dad did. Like, it is literally trying to teach you not only CB lingo but CB etiquette. It is this mm-hmm. lengthy thing, and you can buy a companion booklet to it. So there's just so much stuff. Which is funny, too, that it's on these bulky LPs where it's like, these truckers live in their trucks. Like, I don't know why anybody's buying vinyl, but...
Right? I used to think the same thing when I was little. When do they listen to records? My dad would tell me they have to drive 24 hours a day.
Yeah, so, it's insane. I guess CB...
You're right, though. There were a lot of CB songs, and you asked me that question earlier about, could I brag on my dad, and were people impressed? And people were impressed he had a record, and they were impressed that it went to number one.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell people sometimes, you know, this was the number two selling CB song of all time after Convoy. And people look at me like, well, right, there were probably only two, right? Or maybe three. And it's not true. There were, that's like anything else. You jump on the bandwagon.
Yep.
If it's making money, the record company was going to be all over it.
Mm-hmm.
And between 75 and 77, there were at least 20, I'm sure, maybe more CB theme songs out there on country radio.
Of course. I found one. I got on a kick of these a couple years ago, and I found one called CB Heaven, which is very weird and kind of almost maudlin, but at the same time, like, just, it's real good music, like, as far as country goes. But it's very funny, like, just the kind of, they would just shoehorn. There are several CB Christmas songs, several, like, Santa's, to the point where, again, 2 years ago, I made my own. Well, for no reason, because who's going to listen to a CB Christmas song now? But I thought I'd have a little bit of fun with it. Yeah.
I will listen to your song.
I will send it to you.
I want to hear a CB Christmas song.
I will send it to you. It is the slowest. Like, I kept thinking, oh, this is going to be a fast, fun country song. I'm like, oh, wait, I'm just a singer. I'm not much of a musician. But, you know, it's there, and it's very silly, and it's fun, and I will absolutely send that to you.
He wasn't just lampooning kind of CB culture. He was lampooning some of those serious songs, too.
Yeah.
You have songs like Mercy Day, and what's that one called? Who we got on that end? You're the only friend I got. And they're the maudlin is a good word for it, except they're total parodies. And the funny thing about the second album, making an attempt at some serious songs, he had a lot of fans of his first album who thought those were serious songs. They didn't get the parody aspect to them, and it's because there were so many songs like that.
Sure.
I don't remember CB Heaven, but I remember Teddy Bear. and just these pulling at the heartstrings kind of songs, and that's what he was really satirizing with a couple of the tracks on that first album.
What's interesting too is I feel like I could do a real deep dig on whenever there's a new technology, how that enters popular culture and specifically like recorded media. Because I mean, you go back, you know, years ago, Britney Spears had a song called "Email Me Your Love." Or email mm-hmm. your love, something like that. So, I mean, this is just, it's like, this is the thing. Let us make sure this is inserted into a song. Let's capitalize. Mm-hmm. And I mean, not that that was her big hit, but it was there.
But it was there. And well, it's like the Tom Hanks movie, You've Got Mail.
Yep.
It's this is a new thing, email. And, mm-hmm. you know, the funny thing is the record execs and the studio execs are thinking, hey, this is probably a fad that's going to be gone in 2 years.
Of
so we
course.
Better capitalize on it now.
Of course they are. It's nuts. And this is making me want to dig deeper on it. But my favorite part of this episode is just discovering what I hoped I would, which is not only, of course, there's a complex human being behind this silly album, but like that he had... I think the opposite career that anybody would assume based on the album, based on the stuff they mm-hmm. might know him for, and mm-hmm. People are complicated. And I don't know, to me, that was worth digging into. And I love that I discovered all of this as a result of a weird CB album.
And I'm glad you did. I'm glad it's still out there. And it's funny because he did connect to it. And this podcast is Comedy on Vinyl, and we've talked about comedy albums, and obviously these were comedy songs, but I think he thought of it as a music album, not a comedy album, if
yeah.
that makes sense.
Yeah.
And it was a hit, quote-unquote, song for the comedy. In my opinion, it wasn't anything to do with the melody or the virtuosity of the music, for sure, but But still, in his mind, he was recording songs. He would never have thought to compare this to something like a George Carlin album,
right,
or a Lenny Bruce album or something like that.
Right. Well, and it's interesting, too, because you don't always find people who, with the exception of maybe Stan Freberg, there aren't a lot of people who, when they approach parody music, at least anymore, I guess the best example set by Weird Al, he's a guy who loves and respects all the different music. You don't always find somebody who's like, I don't really like this music. I'm just going to fuck with it. Like, I'm just going to totally make fun of it, but succeeds. Like, because otherwise, you know, this could be a cynical album, but I don't know. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed listening to it. Like I said, there's, you know, it's dated only because it's about CB. The rest of it is like, I bet there's some people who could listen to this and still dig it. I
think there are some things that hold up. I agree with you. I listened to it not long ago. There are some things that don't hold up because a couple of songs are so CB intensive.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's some things that make me laugh today. Like, I'm hearing them for the first time.
Yeah. I enjoy it. I think people, again, I got it. What did I do? I probably think I got it for a dollar. You can pick this up just about anywhere for about a dollar. And that, again, we've discussed this. It doesn't necessarily say anything about the quality, but now I also am going to, I mean, you've convinced me. Now I'm going to have to pick up his second album, or I'll take you up on your offer to send it to me, because why not? Why not have a fresh copy? You know what I'm saying?
Definitely.
I love getting those. You know, every once in a while I get a fresh one from somebody who made the album or has had it sitting around, and it's something special about this one that was only given to the artist. It's got this this different energy to it. That is the weirdest way to talk about that, but that's how it feels to me, because I'm a nerd.
Yeah, the ones that we have, and I only have one copy of each album, but we used to have stacks, and I don't know what happened to the stacks over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow a stack of 20 became a stack of 10 and became a stack of 3, and somehow I have one copy of each. And that's where we are today.
Well, I always ask people, you're not in entertainment, but I want to know if you want to promote anything anyway.
No, not in entertainment. I'm in the always sunny business of being an attorney, really humorous. And so, nope, I don't have anything that I need to promote. I've got a creative side, you know, like people, but I tend to do things for friends and family and not that interested in the fame aspect of it, but.
Sure. Are you a musician by any chance? I'm curious now.
Not at all.
No?
I love music. I adore music, and I have no musical talent. I can't sing. I can't play. All I can do is listen and sit around and talk about music, but nobody wants to hear me do that. So I wish I had a musical talent, but I do.
I have one final question, and that is, would you be at all averse to sending me a picture of that painting of your father? I would really love to see it.
Not at all. Not at all. I'll do it as soon as we conclude here.
That'd be great, because maybe I could put it on the blog. I think people would like to see it. I think it'd be a fun juxtaposition to the back of that album.
Honestly. I was thinking the same thing, and yeah, it would actually, I'm looking at the pose in the painting and the pose on the back of the album. You should definitely put those side by side.
I love it. Well, Rand, thank you so much for doing this. I want to thank everybody for listening. Check out these albums. They're fun. And in general, check out CB culture, because it's a weird part of history that people kind of don't think about much anymore. But that's about it. Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs, and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.